So I was a very young feeling 45-year-old with a 5-year-old child, Musuma, who was my youngest at the time, when I got a diagnosis of stage 4 rectal cancer, seemingly out of the blue. I had a middle child who was going through some stomach issues and had taken her to a couple GI specialists to basically find nothing, but in that investigation, I identified myself as having irritable bowel, and I thought, maybe there's something that's going on with me that would help with her as I, was learning a little more about GI stuff. And I was also having blood in my in the water with stools, not like wrapped up in the stools, but like in the water. So, and I had been told it was hemorrhoids. I'd gone to the doctor about it, but in any event, and I had also been having some mucus in the stools, so they decided to do a colonoscopy. But there was sort of a little of a hesitation to do it because of my age and because my risk factor seemed really low to find any cancer. But anyway, they did a colonoscopy and they did find a tumor. When it was first found, I just assumed it would be stage 1, would just cut it out, would be the easy place to get and carry on. Turned out it was in the rectum, mostly in the rectum, a little bit in the colon, so it wasn't so easy to get. It was a big surgery, and affected my stooling after that. I now have a colostomy bag, but it took a couple of years for that to happen. And the cancer had already spread. One lymph node had been affected, but it had already spread to both lungs. So about a month after the first surgery, I had a second surgery, which turned out to be a right lung lobectomy. So on the right side, there's 3 separate lungs of your lobe. On the left, there's 2. So on the right side, I had one of the lobes removed because the cancer was so deep in there. The doctor who I had felt it was the safest way to remove the cancer. Probably, well, who knows? That's probably a little bit of an old-fashioned way to do it because it's a pretty big surgery to have one of your lobes taken out. And then I did the conventional treatment for 3 months. And that was with my first oncologist, who was a young woman who, I remember feeling like sort of proud of her being like this young woman doctor who was like a real go-getter, but I didn't have a lot of confidence in her as my doctor because she didn't seem to see me as someone separate from statistics. Like she kept trying to wrap me up with what she had heard or was learning or so anyway, she had given me 1 to 3 years to live with that first diagnosis. And she kept sort of saying, well, 20% of the patients, they da, 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 da. And I was like, okay, I was everything she'd say. I just assumed the best for me. And so finally she said, I just want you to know this is what I think. And at the point at that time I wasn't mad, but I was like, who are you to tell me that? And I went and got a different oncologist. But since that conversation, and I've had similar conversations with my current oncologist since then, not for a while, but eventually, I realized, as an oncologist, and I'm sure many other fields of medicine too, but one of their jobs is to tell you, listen, one day you're going to die, as we all are. But I'm just letting you know in case you want to affect how you live or how we do your treatment, because we want to have you to have the best quality of life and try to, rein in this growth. Like there's a lot of things to consider. So I actually, some of my friends, when they hear prognoses that I'm given, they're a little like, how dare the doctor thinks he knows when you're gonna die? Like he's not God. And it's true, and he doesn't. It's complicated because I mean, I've always tried to be open with my kids, and the doctor's always been wrong with the prognosis he's given me. So I've told the kids, I'll tell you once I have better information. But lately, I'm actually now had a big, so it's been 9 years this February. And I've had a really, and I am having a really great run of it. Last summer, I was diagnosed with Lyme's disease.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I had been in and out of chemotherapy treatments. I went to Germany twice. I think I was doing a course with you during one of these, my first trip to Germany. I went to Brazil. I have an integrative oncologist. Like, I do everything. If I think it could be supportive, like, I don't mind trying things. I take supplements. Since the summer, I've had, and the Lyme's disease, which really, and I thought it was the cancer. It was just, I was totally fatigued. I was too tired to eat or prepare food. And at that point, I hired a caregiver to help with that. It was the Lyme's disease, but then since then, the cancer has really progressed and grown a lot. And at this point, so it's was started out as rectal cancer that went to both lungs. In 2020, went to my liver. Has not really been symptomatic there, and has not been yeah hasn't really affected my life a lot there. It's also in the bones of the ribs, and now I feel shortness of breath. I feel a tumor on my esophagus, so it's a little hard to swallow. I can't swallow big pills anymore, and have to be aware of what I eat as well, in terms of bready products that are difficult. I feel I'm on. It's really hard for me to start pain medicine, because that's a whole letting go. I think I had spoken to you earlier about falling asleep is a whole another letting go, but using pain narcotics was really hard for me, because I am just used to like being in my body, feeling my body, talking to my body, working with my body. And I had to use Motrin and lighter narcotics like tramadol or Tylenol number 3, but they had ordered me morphine over the summer, and I'm like, no. I tried it once, it felt terrible, and I just was like, no, like, this isn't for me, or this took away my ability to think clearly. But since then, the pain's gotten to a point where I am on a slow release morphine, and I'm on oxycodone for breakthrough pain, and I'm so grateful. Management, like, whoever invented this, I know a lot of people have suffered with these drugs. But in my case, it has just helped me relax, helped me enjoy this life that I have right now. I'm really grateful.
I'm so happy to hear that. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. I had no idea you were also dealing with like comorbid Lyme disease.
Well, that's thankfully resolved. I mean, and also before that, I had the colostomy bag in 2020 or 2021 maybe, and then last May I had it sort of fixed because I had a hernia, and the surgery didn't heal well. It was about a 6 month period of wounds and like that was a whole nother thing of dealing with constipation and wound care and being on chemotherapy and things not healing. That was a whole nother thing. So things seem to take turns, but right now what's on the forefront is the shortness of breath, the side effects of the pain medicines, and the need to be on the pain medicines, which has a whole scary story with it. That's the hardest part, because it's hard. Pain feels, I'm just not used to it. I've had pain, but not this deep ache deep in your body. So I've really, really, really been really, I mean, back when we were working together, we talked a lot about, being aware of death and how it brings you into life. But when you're really, really actually, and there's been another experience where they were going to have me do hospice care 2 years ago, and I started to get better on a different treatment. But when you really, really are seeing your body decline, physically, feeling it decline, feeling the pain getting worse, struggling to do certain things, that whole death has a whole new intimacy in life. And when I spoke to her, I also believe in miracles. Like, I also believe in, I'm sort of blabbing on here to give, I'm imagining that this might be a podcast. So I'm like sort of giving you my background story here, if you decide.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you just diving right into it to give us the context. And I'm like writing down more questions as you speak, but I'll let you finish your thought and then I'll go back.
Okay.
And ask you
So I spoke with a radical remission survivor because I have been, quote unquote, working very hard at healing. One of the things I had to do is let go of the work and just be, like, let go of the resistance. I haven't used the word being a fighter or a warrior in cancer. I've just, it hasn't felt like what I was doing or wanted to be, but in a way I was, because I was resisting. There's a lot of resistance. And the radical remission survivor said, it sounds not so much that you're afraid of death, but the reason you don't want to die now is because your expectations of when you thought you were going to die aren't being met. Like, I thought I'd die when I was, like, you know, 92 in my sleep. Like, that was what I checked off on the box, I thought, you know, and not 54 with this long period of whatever the experience will be. So being this awareness of death, really walking with death, and the death, the angel of death that I walk with, for me, is a tall gentleman. He's handsome. On one side is my father, who passed away a few years ago from cancer. On the left is the angel of death from the poem, you know, the poem by Carlos Castaneda, of "We're always accompanied by death as our wise advisor." So if we always walk
through, oh, I don't know the poem. I'm going to look that up, but I know that concept because my former boss, Greg, who recently died and had diagnosed my tumor in the past, and he would talk about using death as an advisor from the Carlos Castaneda.
Exactly. Words. So that's where I got that image from. And death's holding my hand, and death's like, at least my death is like pretty funny and pretty nice, fun to hang out with. And you can be like, death, like, should I worry about that? And death's usually, he doesn't say anything. At least mine doesn't. But he usually, like, twinkles in his eyes and he's like, no. I mean, you can if you want to, but, like, is it love? Like, does it really matter? Like, nothing really matters except for what matters, you know? So you can let almost, like, everything go. And I'm like, just last night I prayed so hard and just spoke to the divine, or, you know, just came to me. I said, please, 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 God, please, may I live. And, like, I am living right now. But it just felt so, I felt so, like, out of control of it. I just have to really surrender and let go and just be at peace with whatever it is, because one day this angel of death will, like, you know, who's on my left, will, like, come and embrace me and we become one, and it'll be beautiful, but it'll be different, and I don't know. And I just feel so fortunate because I love my life so much, and I love my kids so much, and I love so much of this experience in my body. I don't want to leave it.
Yeah, I've been particularly curious about your journey with having children and dealing with this, because even if somebody's perfectly healthy and they're deciding that they want to, like, explore using death as a teacher and come and see its end, it seems like something different happens once that person has children, where they're like, and I don't really know what the right answer is. I mean, I'm all open to the mystery and I don't presume to know what it all means and, you know, where we might be going and what the purpose of it is. And if you're a mother, like maybe there's some biological part of you that like doesn't want to contemplate it or think about it because it's because you have people depending on you. So I just find you to be so, it's so incredible to me that you're willing at times to explore this. So I'm wondering about the motherhood piece. And I'm also wondering about the piece in general, like in regards to your relationships, in regards to your life, of being given a prognosis of, you know, this 1 to 3 years to live and having a stage 4 diagnosis anyway, but then living for 9 years up until this point. So I'm wondering about like the pros and cons, I suppose, of believing that you're going to die at a certain point and then like outliving that. Like, does that contribute to your life in a positive way at all, to think that there's a certain point that's going to be the end and then you've gotten more time?
See, I never embraced that idea of the 1 to 3 years. Mm. And I've always just thought they're just giving me the best information that they have on their experience and their studies, which is older people, probably mostly men, like, I don't know, but their studies aren't really, this is a young I'm a new cohort of young, it's an unfortunate growing cohort of young people being diagnosed in this case with colorectal cancer has gone up like 200% in the last, you know, I don't know how many years, but it's a new group. It's a new type of patient. And I went into this super healthy and still I am super healthy considering everything going on. My body is very healthy and strong, which I think was a great benefit. And I do think I did decide that it made the journey a lot more pleasant to really have hope. To keep the hope, you know, and to keep the vision of life as, just keep life forefront, you know, in the life I was living rather than quote unquote waiting around to die. Like, no one's waiting to die. One day you will die. So that's, and with kids, a big part of me is really at this point, okay with dying now. Like, I'm okay with it. I would rather not, because I still want to travel and like spend time with people I love. And, you know, this, like I said, I'm just having such a great time. But what makes me really not want to die is my kids. I have talked to all of them individually recently and as a group, but like, as a mom, so this sounds really, you'd be surprised, at least I'm surprised at what my voices in my head say. One of them is, what, you didn't try hard enough to heal? You don't love your kids enough? You're gonna like,
oh no, gonna don't listen them? To that one.
You're gonna abandon them? I feel like a mom who has like a drug addiction and is like pulled away by this addiction and finds herself like homeless on the streets in Florida or something. And I left my kids, and that mom is heartbroken, but she was like this monster, like pulled her. So this is one feeling of abandonment, guilt. I feel, yeah, guilt, like I'm messing up their life. I'm making them freaking stressed. Taking my daughter's in university. She's abroad in university and having her come home. She wants to be home with me, but like I'm messing up their life, you know, like I feel shame. There's like a shame about dying. Like, seriously, like, oh, you didn't try hard enough in the healing community. There's all this knowledge and all this information about, you know, change your environment so your genes express this and that and keep positive so that your body knows it's safe and be in a healing state and all these things. And I was really working so hard at that, and I realized there were so many emotions and feelings I wasn't feeling to get to these higher states, and I had to feel everything. I had to go through everything and really listen to what my voice said and how, so that those mean voices like aren't true, like they're not, but I was surprised to discover them to discover them in there.
Oh yeah, I think they get to us. Like I saw an meme about this. It's like when you're like laying in bed at night, you're at your most vulnerable. It's like those voices just start to like sense that, and they can sneak in, and they sound so much just like the cultures that I've been a part of anyway, you know, having this kind of warrior mentality that you referred to before that you don't take on about like beating cancer or not, and taking on guilt and shame and trying to control everything. When I think there's so much, I mean, there's other people who have been, you know, perfectly healthy and young and who have done all like the protocols and have done everything that they should do and have died shortly after a diagnosis as well. Like, I just feel like there's like so much mystery as to why we might, you know, like live a certain amount of time, and we can have an intuitive, you know, sense about things as well, about like how we want to approach it, that, and that can be so individual. But I do see you referred to just like feeling it all. So I'm curious about, you have that like one voice that's telling you that, which just sounds like the culture of the dominant culture of North America about how we should approach things and what it all means. And I'm curious about that other one, which might have been what you were referring to before, about like how you approach it, and like in some sense, like it's all perfect and okay and nothing really matters. Like, I wonder about the other bit positive voice that speaks to you.
So this became really evident. This story came evident to me in a meditation that I did a couple months ago. I was at a meditation retreat, a Jon Kabat-Zinn retreat in upstate New York. And the question he invited everyone to think about and sort of meditate on was, why are you here? He said, there's a well, take a pebble and drop it in the well, like look into the well and the stone will drop, and be like, okay, when it falls, be like, okay, why am I here? And then look at it falling deeper and the ripples of the water flowing, and then why am I really here? And just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. So apparently I was on Jack and Jill's hill, because it was a big steep, I mean, well, because it was a big hill to get up the well to the well. And I actually had a boulder. It wasn't a pebble. It was this big rock, like Sisyphus, you know, the Greek myth of like pushing the rock up and, you know, one step forward, two steps back, like this very huge task. And then this boulder sort of turned to be ascites, like under my shirt, you know, and I was carrying this huge burden of weight.
Oh, within. Oh.
Yeah, within. And then it became sort of like the ball and chain, like I was dragging it with like my foot from as a prisoner. And I get to the top and I finally, I'm like hoisting this boulder over, and on it was tattooed in like prison style tattoo, like not some cool, like, it's like written really rough, messy writing that said, heel bitch. Yeah. And I threw it over and I could hear it screaming in this big splash of like, wow, like flying. It was a kind of like drama movie or something. And I was like, holy, holy crap. You know, what the hell is that about? And then my heart said, Sarah, that's actually not your pebble. It's in your pocket still. And I was like, thank God.
Oh.
I take my pebble out and I throw the pebble in, and the pebble falls and said, my darling, you've done the best you can. Like, you've done the best you can with the resources you have and you've had. And you've done great, and it's been great. And just be loving to yourself. Just, you know, eat those chocolate chips. Like, it's okay. Like, enjoy your life. Like, just be in joy, be in love, be with whatever you're feeling. Feel the fear, feel the grief, feel the love. Just like feel it all. It's all fine. It's all okay. You're okay. It's all okay. And like, you're safe. I don't know what it was, but something like that. And it was just such a relief to like let that boulder go, just throw it away. And I mentioned earlier, I have a colostomy bag. And so that idea of letting go of shit, like emotional shit or baggage or weight or sludge, or, you know, that's been an image or something I've had to work through too. Of, in healing cancer, there's a book written called Radical Remission by Kellyanne Turner. She did her PhD on this because there's so many people who are having these, they call them spontaneous remissions, or they're not studied. but they have been there have been millions of undocumented cases and a lot of documented in the literature. So she started studying them, and there's like 10 healing factors. And a lot of them I had gone to just instinctually, like, you know, have a good medical team and spiritual and social support. And one of them is releasing suppressed emotions. So that's been my sticky thing. So now when I cry, I'm like, yay. Like, it's in everything that matters. And this is what death taught me, is love. Everything. So your heart aches. Like, it aches because you love that person. Your heart is singing and in such joy because you love. And with the radical remission person that I spoke with, another thing she said was, I said, I don't want to like mess up their life when I die. Like, I don't want, and since then I've realized they're totally loved. Their father's amazing. You know, they're going to be okay. Yes, they have these certain issues. That's their journey. They're working through their thing. And our love is so profound and so deep. And that doesn't die. You know, my body will die. My mind will die. I think, I don't know. That's what I heard, you know. And, but the love doesn't die. The spirit doesn't die. And it's made our relationship. I have the most wonderful relationship with my kids. They're 15, 19, and 22 now. And when I was diagnosed, my youngest was in kindergarten. And she told me after she got my diagnosis, we didn't know prognosis or anything, but there was a boy in the neighborhood who had died of cancer. And every year we had a run in his honor and would raise money for him. She said to me when she was 5, she said, Mommy, if you die, I think we should bury you by the tree by the front door, because then every day I'll see you. And that tree that's outside my bedroom window. And I said, okay. And then a couple of days later, she came back to me and she said, Mommy, I've decided I really don't want you to die. I don't want you. I just want you here. I don't want you to be in the tree, or, you know. But she had been working through this. We've all been working through this. And when I told my daughter, who was in university, about feeling guilty for making them all go through this, she said, Mom, this has been such a hard journey for everybody, but we're all growing. You're growing. I've always loved and admired you, but it's just grown. How you're present with us, it's just grown. We were all growing. Like, my ex-husband, we're like best friends. We love each other like we never loved each other. We weren't able to love each other in the marriage in this way, but we're free now to totally love each other, because I see how he loves me and loves the kids. That's all that matters. And so just to feel like, not forgiven, because I was never unforgiven, but to feel that grace that my daughter gave me. And but the kids, that's the thing that keeps me like really being like, just I'll do one more treatment, I'll do whatever, like, versus being like, no, I'm just gonna let go and fly, you know. But that's the kids is yeah, like, I want to be a grandma in 10 years or 15 years. But, like, I want to, like, the intention's out there right now. In case anyone's listening. So, you know, I want to be an old lady. Like, I'm super excited about it. I want to, yeah, and I'm so grateful for this day. Like, yeah, so it's a really amazing combination of being incredibly happy and grateful and feeling grief and fear too about like suffering, you know, working through pain versus suffering, which is I was a child birth educator and a labor and delivery nurse, and we talked a lot about pain versus suffering in labor. And suffering comes when you feel not heard or seen or validated, which in a lot of my life, in some relationships, that's how I felt, actually. So that's where the suffering came. I don't feel that at all now. I feel very seen, very heard, very present, very valued, very loved. So physical pain, it's like all being considered and taken seriously and really supported. So I'm hoping I don't think that feeling of suffering will be there. There might be a different kind of, you know, I don't really want to use the word suffering, work, hard work.
Oh my gosh, there's just so much there that, I was thinking like along this pathway of you sharing about those radical remission stories and how you instinctively looking back were possibly like following that protocol without knowing it. And it sounded like part of that protocol involved feeling. And I just want to put this out there. I want to send this to every woman I know who doesn't think it's okay to, and man, everybody, every person that doesn't feel like it's okay to feel their feelings. I feel like it's a huge issue and doesn't feel like it's okay to like have open conversations about the harder aspects of life. And just one example is like that you go to just these beautiful words. Thank you so much for sharing that about your daughter talking openly about where your body maybe should go once you die, but also the paradox of, and I really don't want you to, of course, but the willingness to, yeah, like feel it anyway and talk about it despite how difficult it is. And then the other extreme of that, like regarding pain and like eating the chocolate and all of that and like what the little stone told you, like I like love that as well, because it's like, come on people, like take the, I don't want to advocate, like I just know when it comes to my own, like when I've dealt with like pain after surgeries and things, like give me the pain meds. And I think when I get close to the, it's like, what? I don't know, personally, everybody has their own thoughts on that, but like, I'm so glad that you're able to just like, gosh, there's like so much in there, which leads me to a question too about like, I didn't know you before this at all. Like, how have you changed? Like when your daughter that was in college was like sharing with you, I mean, she sounds incredible to like have this awareness now. That's something you would normally have like looking back on your life. Like, I'm so glad my mom was able to be present with me. So it sounds like she's even become somebody she might not have been, like wise beyond her years. And I wonder if that has anything to do with who you have become through all these challenges with illness that you've dealt with. So I'm like wondering, like, if you can kind of compare like who you were before to who you are like since the diagnosis. Oh, I'm wondering how you've changed.
Yeah, like I was actually, so I'm good at explaining all this now because I've been really thinking and doing a lot of writing and exploring these things lately as I've had more time and space to, actually, you know, when you're less busy. I have somebody who cooks for me now. I'm not gonna say they were spoiled, just loved, man. I mean, especially when you're a mother and you're used to taking care of people and sort of making sure everyone has what they need, just to let that go and then really do these projects you want to do, which are things that all parents want to do, is, you know, put together photo albums and write poems and think about their thoughts and all these things. So some big dichotomies have been coming up, like even being a little girl, and I was raised in a loving family with people doing their best, and remembering feeling like, don't piss off mom, don't, she has four kids, this is like a lot going on, and she likes the house neat, and just try to keep together and don't be too crazy. And even growing up, I always felt a lot of judgment about, I was just so carefree and so not taking my life seriously. That's how it seemed, when really that was one of my gifts, was this really joyous nature. And I had been in depression as well at that those ages, but I could feel the joy because I had felt the despair as well. And but one strategy I developed to deal with these sort of conflicting feelings I had sometimes of who am I and is it safe to express myself? Will my love, will I get my needs met? Will I get loved the way I want to if I'm act a certain way or have to pretend to be something else? And who am I anyway? And I don't even know what I want. Sometimes I literally didn't even know what I wanted. And I would tend to distract myself with activity. I'm from New York. Like I really like the adrenaline rush of like getting the train and, you know, getting somewhere and everything working out. And like, I'm not in a rush, but just, it's fun just to be productive or, and that sort of continued having kids because there's always something else to do to prepare, like make the lunches for the next day and get the diaper bag. But like, there's always something to do. And yet, fortunately, I was able to say in my head from 4 to like 8 every day, I'm home from work. I'm just with the kids. This just is my time. I'm not going to call anyone. I'm not going to do anything with the kids and making dinner and putting the, I'm doing all the work for them. But my kids remember me hanging out with the moms, you know, in our back deck and like drinking wine and laughing and being silly, but not being really present at those, in those moments. Or I'm trying to think of other examples. Like when I was first diagnosed and was on chemo, I was just lying on the sofa in the living room. Just no one was noticing me. My daughter was 5 and she was playing with her friend. And I was just lying there laughing because they were so funny. They were like playing with Legos and had this whole story going on. And yeah, I'd been a mom for like 15 years and I never just sat like a fly on the wall and just watched the kids play without them noticing me. And it was really fun. And I thought, this is a great gift, you know, of just observing them. And then I could, anyway, that's being present. That's not really being present with them, but just observing them and getting to know them in a way I hadn't known, because I was usually there playing and I'd be making dinner or doing something. But and just today, my 15-year-old, she's home from school sick, and she said, and one of the perks of being divorced is there's 2 homes. So when you're on chemotherapy or something and your kid's sick, you can send them to the other house. So anyway, she's at dad's right now. And she called me, she said, I still don't feel well enough to go to school and I feel really guilty about it because I've missed X, Y, and Z days. And I said, Naomi, guilty? I'm glad you observed that you feel guilty. But you know when you're bullshitting yourself or not. Like, if you need to stay home because you don't feel good, if you need to do anything to take care of yourself, to make yourself feel loved, to make yourself feel safe, to make yourself have the needs you need met, do it. Like, I'm giving her these big like life lessons, like an example of just staying home from school one day, because I'm like, this is a great example. Don't feel guilty ever. And I'm glad if you notice it, awesome. We all feel guilty for stuff and it wastes our energy. And if you're guilty about it and it's like, really, I could be doing that, I should be doing that, then do it. And if you really don't feel up to it, then don't. It's totally fine. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. It's totally fine.
And so, yeah, you mentioned, oh, go ahead.
Oh, you can interrupt me because I'll just blab like crazy, so.
Well, when you're, if another one comes to your mind, I would love to hear it. But like, I've identified 3 big ones when, in regards to like who you are through this experience. And like, presence is huge. It's just one word, but like actually able to become that, have your daughter even identify it, despite dealing with things that might even want to take you out of your body even more. When I feel pain, I know it's like even harder. Like I just want to numb. And then you also referenced like your relationship to suffering has changed. It's just one word as well, but it's so huge, like pain versus suffering. And like, as you look forward, and I just would be afraid I would become even like more neurotic through some of this stuff. And so, oh yeah, something I really want to get into is you mentioned in the past you've dealt with something that I think a lot of other people I've talked to, especially women, deal with. It's just like not being like not feeling heard. And I've especially heard that in regards to dealing with illness and medical staff and all of that. So like, how did that change, like post-diagnosis, that you don't like that you feel heard now when you didn't before?
So I actually wrote a list of this stuff.
Ooh.
I'm gonna just pull it up so I see here. Someone I'm working with asked, "Why do you think you got cancer? Like, this isn't true. This is just in your head." And one was the feeling that love was conditional that I had explained to you. As a kid, like I had to act a certain way to get loved. And even in my marriage, if I was too crazy or not, or too emotional or too volatile, it was the person I was with wasn't able to be in that space. It was too scary for him. So realizing that love actually is unconditional and that love is. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm surrounded by love. Like, and I mean by every single person I'm in contact with, like the mailman, when I go to the doctor, even the person checking me in this like basement, totally depressing office that I would be really not happy to be there all day. And I'm so grateful for them. And they're like kind and loving to me. Like everyone's loving to me. And my mom recently told me, and we have an amazing relationship now, and we've always really loved each other, despite the fraughtness I mentioned. She said, "Sarah, I'm so sorry. I'm like embarrassed to tell you this. I'm so sorry, though. I think it took you getting cancer for me to realize how much I loved you, like unconditionally. Yeah, like the judgment you felt, because we've talked about all this stuff. Was because I thought you were so awesome." And I'm like, how come like she's not doing like reading more books or going to doing things that to her felt awesome? Like, how come but now as I am feeling emotions and able to feel them and express them, this is new, and share them with her, that's a big thing. That she's able to hear and appreciate and grow and learn with me. It's been incredibly this amazing gift. And I really appreciated her telling me that because I felt that. And it's nothing to be ashamed of, even though it sounds bad. It's like that. And also, that love that I'm feeling so much now was always there. So that's something I try to tell my cancer. Well, it's not my cancer, the cancer. This is the cancer of the world. It's like, this love is always there. It's always been there. I don't need cancer to be loved. I don't need cancer to be heard or have my needs met. Like, it's there. It's always been there. Another one was I didn't feel my authentic self valued. I had, considering how I showed up in the world, I actually had a part of me that had low self-esteem. And even now I'm aware of, oh, I hope the nurse isn't mad at me because I didn't like go to the ER when she told me, like something like that. And I'm like laughing at myself because I'm like, that's ridiculous. But I'll observe that I care what someone thinks about and almost change how I present something. Even a friend who really wants me to heal and is teaching me or telling me about healing meditations. And oh, but I'm like, I don't want to tell her I'm not feeling good. Like, and I'm like, no, that's ridiculous. I can be however I am. No one's judging me. It's me. So that's a big let it go. And
Oh, I'm so inspired right now. Keep going.
then I didn't feel emotionally safe to feel certain feelings and to express them. Like, yeah, to feel, it was almost like if I'm afraid, and even like start investigating. Okay, this is two different thoughts. if I'm afraid, does that pull me out of love? Like, does that make me, am I one thing or the other? Can I be afraid and also empowered? Can I be alive and also embracing death? Like, yes, you can be all these things. And like with my kids, now what I say to them is, honestly, I do not know what's going on. All I can tell you is what the doctor said. Here's what the doctor said, which now is like, you have a couple months. I could tell you how I'm feeling, which is the pain's getting worse. I'm on my pain medication, but every day is different. Today I took an awesome walk out in the sun, and slept really well. And yesterday I couldn't get up from the toilet. It was hard. Like every day is different. I'm just trying to be open to it. And then the last thing is I can tell you like what my inner voice says. And she's just like, she's still super hopeful. I'm like, we'll be surprised if some miracle doesn't happen. And I keep, so there's all these things and they're all true, even though they're all totally a different thing. So I tell my kids that too. And I recently told them, I said, so, we had conversations and my son was like, Mom, are you dying? And I was like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it, but sometimes I think so. And this, yeah, like I don't should be shocked because one, I've always told them one day I'm gonna die. I don't know how or when, but it's gonna happen as we all are. But now it's like I'm really sure that one day I'm gonna die. I feel certain things now that make me think maybe it's close. But I have no idea. But I don't want you to be shocked. And I want you to know how much I love you and how, I want you, I don't want you to ever think, I wish I had more information. I would have chosen some things differently or done different things with my time. Or I just want to give them that information. And,
I keep on having this. Oh, were you still? I think there
oh
was a
no, that was
delay. Go
good.
ahead.
Basically, the last thing that I've become aware of is that my soul said, Sarah, if you're going to live, I want you to be alive. I want to live. And the soul in this healing culture I'm talking about, this healing, it's like your soul will keep talking to you until you listen, even if it takes getting a cancer diagnosis to listen. So I try to tell my soul, I hear you. I'm figuring it out. I totally, this is what your whole book's about. Like, how do you be fully alive? How can you like not be numbed out? And drinking wine and just not thinking. I mean, it's fine for you to drink wine, I'm all over it. But like, not to feel like you have to numb out to not feel certain feelings or to distract yourself.
Oh, but it's still so hard. I feel like it's not something that you just write down and like just take in and easily grasp. And I'm constantly like looking at that of like, what does it mean to really live? And that's probably part of the reason I wanted to do this interview with you too. Because it's a question that I think that evades a lot. I mean, in the workshops anyway, like, or when I get to deep conversations with people, like we kind of start to reveal like how difficult that can be. And it leads to another question of, with all these ways that your life has changed, would you ever have conceived of this, like after getting that diagnosis or even before, like if you were ever to think about like, oh, if I were to get like a diagnosis like this, like has your life changed in ways that you would have ever imagined it would? Or was it different than what you considered?
So the question is a little different that I'm what I'm hearing is almost like, is it was it worth it? Is this diagnosis,
Oh,
the illness worth
no,
all
that's
the
a
good, all the good, all you've learned, all this, higher understanding you've gotten about yourself, is it worth it? And honestly, if I die, like, yes, it's worth it, but I still want to be one of those triumphant stories where, yay, and she lived 20 more years or 10 or 7, and your real question was,
right, so
did I
that's
enjoy
not the way
my
that I
life?
meant it, but
Yeah,
I was just
no, I envisioned my life working. I loved my job. I loved running. I loved doing my dancing and hanging out with my friends, and I was having a great time. And I would have gotten divorced still, and we probably would have had a nice divorce, but I wouldn't be so full in love that I am. And so, because when you really feel death knocking at your door, all these things people tattoo on themselves or hang up on their wall, like to live, laugh, and love, and all this stuff, you feel it viscerally. And and you cry about it. Like, it's not just the thought, it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's beyond a thought. It's beyond a concept, even. It's just becomes more embodied. And, but it's not every second all the time. You know, I'm reminded of these things. I've learned this lessons every single day 100 times again. Even the whole thing with the death. I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah, what I mostly meant by that is and maybe you didn't even really like look forward to your future in this moment, but I'm wondering like with receiving the diagnosis of the cancer, you might have like a certain like image of your future with that diagnosis. So if you had one, I was wondering if it lined up with how life actually has been.
The image I had was when the doctor told me at that time I'd been reading a lot of Harry Potter to my fourth grader. And I said, well, if cancer's Voldemort, I'm Harry Potter. That's what I said to him. And he looked at me and I think he's not a, I don't think he knew what I was talking about. And I said, well, I haven't finished the books yet, but I'm assuming Harry Potter wins, right? Like, hope. Because but I just assumed I would go through all these tribulations and I would good would prevail. I wasn't even worried about it. I mean, I was, but I wasn't. I felt strong. I felt invincible. Like, I felt like almost like a teenager. Like, I'm not going to be the one who gets in the drunk driving accident. Like, no, I'm the one who lives. I'm the one who can do this. I really felt that way. And I was a little pissed off when the doctor kept insisting that I was going to die in a couple of years. And then my next oncologist said, I have no idea. Right now, you're not an inevitable. He said, but I don't know. But your job now is to have fun with your kids. Live your life, always have a plane ticket, always have a plan, do your job, drink as much wine as you want. Some were saying, how much wine can I have a day? He said, no more than half a bottle. Anyway, but he was just like, live your life, enjoy your life. And that's continued to be his message. It's just now, it's like, how can you best live your life? Because there is a lot for me of mental health that goes along with this. Anxiety, depression, mental health. I haven't really had depression with it, but I've had a lot of anxiety regarding all of this, and he can really tell.
It sounds like your doctor's amazing. I'm so glad that you listened to yourself when the other doctor sounds like she was perfectly good, but just didn't feel right, and that you listened to yourself to find somebody else, and that you've been on this journey with one for so,
He doesn't always
yeah.
feel right either.
Not
Like
perfect.
some of my friends who are like, they're like, I don't know why he's so worried or why he's so do Dr. Doom, you know. But I really think it's a hard job. And he's very knowledgeable, and he has certain tools that he knows about, and he thinks the other things I do, if it's not messing up what he's doing, he's fine with it. But he's sometimes a little dismissive about it. That's okay.
Yeah, it's hard to be able to talk to most conventional doctors. Like even I feel like I shouldn't out myself about that around most of them, like the alternative stuff. But how do you deal with, I mean, both the with the pain and like, do you have any techniques that you use to deal with the pain or the anxiety or anything else in regards to it?
So I was using so with the anxiety, I've been doing the main thing was sort of like different types of meditation and exercise. Just I mean it was running and then it went to walking and just breathing. But there was times when the anxiety was like really gripping, and I can look back at different points on this journey, and I was more in distress about death and dying than I am now. And I wasn't having any pain. I was maybe having some issues with, sometimes I was having nothing. Sometimes I was having issues with chemotherapy. Because another great thing with my doctors, he will sort of pull me in and out of different regimens and try to treat my body as gently as possible. So instead of just giving the whole shebang, whatever the protocol is, he literally listens and tries to follow my body. So that's, I think, why I was also able to tolerate so many things for so long, is because it was gentle, it was done gently. But the, yeah, the anxiety was really big. And so, yeah, just sort of experimenting with breathing, meditation, talking to people about it. I always have had different sort of therapy going on. I've had a death doula consistently for about 4 years, and it's gone in and out of how often I needed to speak with her. And I just think of her as like a love therapist, you know. Yeah, and so lately I've wanted to talk to her more because it's more like logistical things, you know. And but in terms of the anxiety, recently when I started getting into the pain medicine, which has been great, like I mean I was even hesitant to try. I was trying, you know, cannabis, and I had tried microdosing mushrooms. Like I was trying other things, and even like the cannabis was hard for me with the letting go because I wasn't seeing pain relief with it. But with this, with the pain relief, I like am really happy to be a little stoned out sometimes. Like it's been really, I'm really happy with that, that I'm able to relax despite the pain, because it really helps with the pain. This, and it gives me confidence that I can carry on, because because I have these drugs that can help me.
Oh, I've heard this so much in hospice too. I've heard hospice nurses just say it over and over again that if people don't stay on top of it, then it makes it harder. Sometimes they go on to hospice. You referenced even maybe going on some years ago. And then they actually get better because like all of their symptoms are dealt with and they can like relax and they wish they had gone on it way sooner.
Well, I just got hooked up with a new palliative care team, and they are so, who works right with my doctor. I don't know why I wasn't hooked up with them before. But anyway, they're on my symptoms. They speak to me once a week. It's a social worker, a pharmacist, and a nurse practitioner. And it's just been amazing that I don't have to worry about that. Like they're worrying about that for me, like the constipation and the pain, and I have to, you know, it's just been, it's been really helpful. But it's a new technique I tried recently because I've been on this pain medicine. I just knew instinctively, and also from being a nurse, that like I didn't want to be on lorazepam for anxiety, which I had been on, and opioids at the same time. It just seemed like I need it because I was already like, one thing, the opioids are actually helping with the anxiety, but when I feel a big feeling that I would label it as anxiety, I'm sort of now like, what is that feeling? Like, what is it? And let me feel it. It's okay. Let's feel it. And so I'll just feel it and even let it get big. And then it passes. And it's not so scary. So that's what I've been doing lately, has been just feeling it and exploring it and writing about it. Like I'm much more curious. One of my superpowers throughout my whole life has always been I'm really curious. Like, if I do anything, like, I want to learn about it. Like, I want to be like the best I can be at it, or investigate other, like, with running. Like, I was interested in, like, Thai running. Like, it's called like Qi running, I think it's called, where you sort of add in breath in certain positions and to be really gentle on your body. And so even with death and dying, like, I'm really curious of like the Tibetan book of living and dying, and like, people's stories of like Anita Morjani's story of dying and coming back to life, and what did she learn in that, and how did she talk about it, and how that was a big sort of revelatory thought of, you don't have to work at healing, like, it's just being in love. That was sort of her takeaway. And anyway, I sort of forgot what I was talking about here,
Oh no,
but
that's perfect. Way to pause because I have so many things I'm writing down. So, and I want to wrap up soon too because I know we talked about doing things for so long. And if you want to
well,
rest,
this has
then
been
that's
great
good.
because I'm doing this for you as well as for me, because I appreciate you recording this so I can have it, my thoughts sort of documented in a way that can be revisited by me or my kids when they're ready. Or so thank you for doing this and honoring my story and my journey in this way. I'm very grateful and honored that
Oh,
you
so glad.
care and feel this connection to me over all these years. I feel the same way about you. I've always just, I think that's that sisterhood thing, like, just felt that connection.
Oh gosh, I just have the chills running through my body. Thank you so much for saying that and for being willing to do this. I'm so glad. I mean, I think I had to call an inspiration from you to follow through and do it because I was like, gosh, I really want to do this. It's been coming to me for a while. It feels really important. I think we can feel when something comes from our angels or source or whatever that is, where it's like it's important to do this. And then I noticed myself like hesitating or not wanting to bother you. So I'm just like so grateful for you taking the time. And when you've said that you don't always like have the stamina and you might have pain or symptoms and you're sitting with all of that right now and you're sharing everything just like so honestly. And I so appreciate it.
Well,
And
sharing and being heard actually is very invigorating. So I was so tired before this. That's why I took a nap, and I thought, oh gosh, I hope I'm not moving. But just talking to you and really feeling held and heard and all these amazing things that you've been talking about this whole time, is very, yeah, I feel very full of energy and full of life. Yes. So thank you.
I could feel that coming from you, so thank you. And oh gosh, I want to speak to these other because I'm thinking about like other people listening to this as well, beyond it just being a conversation between the two of us too. And you mentioned with using like palliative care, and I'm glad that you're calling on these resources of like using a death doula as well. So I wasn't expecting to ask you this at all, but like I'm wondering more about that journey and how it's been helpful, even like a long time ago before you even wanted to start planning logistically for things.
Yeah, so, well, one thing is, the I somehow, I don't know how I stumbled across the Reimagine website, which, and if you're Googling Reimagine, you have to go Reimagine Death, because there's a bunch of Reimagine websites out there. It was Reimagine Death, and that's how I found you. And there's all these free resources. This was right around the time of the pandemic, and everything was just shifting to be online. I think they had more in person before, but now I think most stuff is online. And so I started to explore, and the whole idea is reimagine how we talk about death. Like, let's talk about it. Like, you're born, you live, you die. Like, if I'm gonna have a baby, I can talk to you about having a baby. And the baby's inside me, and then the baby goes through this dark tunnel and doesn't know what's going on. Well, maybe they do, I don't know. And then they come out into the light. So that's like that. It's just as normal as all that. And it's okay. Like, it's okay to talk about it. And it's actually great to talk about it. It's big relief. It's because there's no shame about it. This is awesome. This is like, let's empower ourselves through this. It's really freeing. So that was the whole reimagine idea. And then through them, like I said, I found you, I found a couple other workshops, and I found a woman who was doing a workshop, which I didn't do, but I Googled her, and her name's Andrea Dearhart, and she has a nonprofit called The Heart Way, and she gives services for free. It's donation based or not, depending on if you're able to or not. As a death doula, and she also has a program now as that she's a teacher, teaching this art to others. And basically I reached out to her and I said, this is sort of what I'm dealing with and confronting with. It's about 3 years in my journey, and I'm looking for someone to talk to so I can live my life as fully as possible. Are you that person? She wrote me back, yes. And so she's been great, and there's been a couple times we've had like a Saturday morning, this is all on Zoom, a Saturday morning session, because I felt so anxious or something. It was maybe once or twice. And I have met her in person. She's in California. I'm in Maryland. And she just referred me to somebody local who's one of her apprentices, I'm going to meet with her, and she's going to be sort of my bedside person and my person to work with. And it just feels really, again, pain versus suffering. Like, there's no suffering. Like, it just feels really supportive, so loved. And Andrea also is hoping to be able to be with me in person. And also, I feel like I don't have to figure everything out. You know, it's a way of my family and loved ones loving me by honoring me or celebrating me before, during, and after my life. But just, I want to get certain things in place, like make things, if I have any wishes or, you know, passcodes, just like I want to make some things easy for them. And also just think about, you know, do I want to be buried or do I want to do cremation? Like, we usually do this in my family, but what, you know, what feels right and what's practical? And so having those conversations too. But she's been great with, she sort of has a Buddhist bent. She'll speak in any language, whatever spiritual language is your language, you know, or whatever context. And she's also, it was also really helpful being a parent, working with her. And then, so that was one person I mentioned, the palliative care, which is different than hospice. Basically, palliative care is a way to have a dedicated team to deal with symptom management so that your, in this case, oncologist can focus on your disease management. So, and the oncologist does all the other stuff, but as well, but it's sort of, it's a team to sort of support the oncologist. So they do, for me, they do pain, anxiety as well, if that was an issue now. In the past, it has been constipation. They have a social worker, so helping just get some resources, or if I needed help with the advanced directives, and a neuropathy. The pharmacist is very like, I have cough, which is very painful. And so what drugs are helpful with the cough, as well as with the pain I have in my lungs, which are partly nerve and referred pain in my back. And so it's just a more thorough investigation of all this stuff by experts that just work in this way. And this is complementary, but different than hospice care, which, as it's been explained to me, is when you're not doing a treatment anymore to control the disease, but basically supportive care. So usually, depending on your insurance, you'll get a nurse visit probably once a week. You might get a home health aide a couple hours a week. Most plans tend to try to support you at home. I already have a hospital bed in my room. I call it a mechanical bed, which reminds me of a mechanical bull, which I think is really funny. But I don't use hospital bed, partly because I don't want to like alarm anybody, and particularly my kids. which is funny because here I am saying I'm being so authentic and real. But also I realized that I have a story with the word hospital bed from my dad having a hospital bed. And he got it a few weeks before he died. And just this, and I'm a nurse and I worked in a hospital. So like, but it's associations I have with the word. So I call it a mechanical bed and I pretend it's in a spa because my room looks like a spa now because I have a big bed and then my hospital bed. And so it's a lot of beds. And I'm trying to think if there's any other resource. Oh, so the hospice care is actually, doesn't mean like, okay, sign up, that's around the corner. It's basically how can we just love and support you as full as we can? And often it's a lot more than they can up until that point. It's a lot, it's like palliative care, much more. It's that's what it all is about. And if you needed to go in like to be cared for in a facility, that's also an option usually.
No, I like that you bring up like all these resources that people just tend to be afraid of. I know from working in hospice as well that it would often be like, I already mentioned this, but people would be so resistant. And then they would decide to go with it. And they're like, I wish I did this sooner. I'm like, I've heard this so many times that I need to go out and become like a hospice advocate to like, let people know what it is and what it isn't. And that sometimes you can even continue with a treatment if it's considered palliative. So even if that is like radiation or chemo, I mean, there's like certain regulations around it. I think that just helps kind of free people up to just, and then you can always, I mean, you shouldn't be just jumping on and off of it, but it's like, it's not just, oh, I'm giving up now, so I'm choosing hospice or palliative or a death doula. That, yeah. And so with your death doula sessions, were you able to, was it a lot of, like when you said that that helped decrease your anxiety, one, I just find it to be so interesting and I feel the same way, where it's like exploring death or hearing other people's like stories around illness, like it helps decrease my anxiety or facing it or planning for it, instead of increase it. And it reminds me too of like that feeling of actually, you mentioned taking the time to feel your feelings instead of pushing them away, then the feeling actually passes sometimes. So that what a paradox that is as well, like with opposite of what you would think and opposite of what our culture tells us. So with those death doula sessions where you noticed your anxiety decreasing, was that from talking with her? Like what were those sessions like over Zoom?
So I mentioned befriending death and having that angel walking next to me. That was actually a lot working with her as well, having this long-term relationship with becoming aware of death, noticing how I felt about it, death and dying, and then actually being able to befriend this or be aware of my stories and how to feel comfortable with this and the known and the unknown, like so much is unknown. And so she has, basically it was, it's talking. Usually we start with like a little, she'll have like a little meditation, just a little thing of sort of, and it changes through the years. She used to not do it. And then she had sort of a, just a way to ground together. And now she sometimes thinks of like a light coming in and connecting you to the earth. And she's really into yoga nidra as a way to sort of relax your body and observe your body. And there's a, so it was just, she's met my kids in person and over the virtually. And my kids have been, I think she's a beautiful person, but medium receptive to speaking with her, like actually not receptive to speaking with her at this point. But it's just really nice for me to know she knows me so well. And I'm not just my kids, my mom, my family, whoever. She's there for them as needed. And I'm actually going to request in my like wishes that I want my kids to have a certain amount of sessions with her, a certain amount of sessions with somebody, sort of just process this and to feel what they feel. Because another thing I realized, and this is all these things I'm realizing are taken like threads from all working with different people and myself, so a lot of this is from working with her, but I realize I feel very protective of my kids. Like, I don't want them to be sad. I don't want them to be, paralyzed by grief. And here, I'm just putting the stories on what I imagine it could feel like after really a beloved mother. I am a beloved mother. How fortunate am I, that dies. And she's been really important part of your life. And how to keep that relationship going in this new way, like, man, that's tough. And how to, as a mother, how can I fully love and support my kids and believe in them? They're going to be okay, and they're going to grieve because they love me. And that's important. The grief is amazing. It's important. It's beautiful. It's hard, and that's a whole nother thing. I'm doing my grief work, and they're doing their grief work now from what we are experiencing. But after I die, what is that look like, and how could they be loved and supported in that? And how can I really feel like, I'll say, really feel like proud. I feel really proud that they can, and that they can do this. I know they can. It's their journey. If it's their journey, I, whatever they're called upon to do, they can do. And who am I to say, no, don't grieve. Don't be too sad. No. That's, my instinct is to try to help, but no, that's not helping anybody.
You
So,
already have, right? Oh, finish. Go ahead.
oh, go ahead. There you go.
I was just thinking, like, from the way that you're going through this journey, I keep on thinking about the movie Grief Walker with Stephen Jenkinson. Have you
I
seen
never
that?
saw
It's a
that.
documentary. There's this moment in the documentary. He's somebody out of Canada who has been with people like at the end of their lives, and there's a story of like a child dying in that, and there's a story of like a mother and how she would go about her death. And when they're recording her, she's actually on a couch in the living room and she can't really move much at that point. And he's explaining how the way she dies is teaching them, and like the way that she lives is teaching them. So it just keeps on coming to my mind throughout this whole talk, is how if you're worried if you've prepared them for that or not, it's like by being who you are, by being who you've become through this, I feel as if you have prepared them.
Yeah, as best I could, Yeah, I have a friend whose grandmother said, as she was on her deathbed, she said, "I've taught you how to live, and I'm going to teach you how to die." Basically, is with dignity and grace and gratitude. And this is how I imagine, and with this matriarch of the family, and I really love that idea, that image, because if you're relaxed about it, if you could be at peace with it, then your loved ones know that you're okay.
Yeah, in moments, and then in other moments, like you described, it's okay for them and you to feel grief and to feel that
Right.
fully and to be so. Isn't that part of it? And isn't that so beautiful? Like, if you weren't never to like have these relationships because you were too afraid to have them to begin with, and you wouldn't have the pain of that. Like, isn't the pain a good thing out of that? Like, of that, isn't the grief a good thing? And yeah, we should kind of come to a close. There's a big question I want to ask you to end. But I also want to know from you before I ask you that big question, if is there anything else that you would want to be asked or other things you'd want people to know? That puts some pressure
I
on
don't think so. I
you.
think we've done a pretty thorough job. Thank you.
Thank you. You've done a great job explaining and sharing your stories too. So, yeah, the last question is something that Oprah always asks people, and it's, what do you think happens when we die?
Oh, I asked my death doula this. I said something like, "You're so into this whole dying thing. You've been researching it and working with people for, 30 years or plus. I said, how do you want to die? Or how do you think it's going to be? And she goes, I want to die really slowly because I don't want to miss anything. I want to just, she was like really like curious about it. And like, she said, I think it's going to be bliss. I think it's bliss. The next, I don't know if that's what she said. That's what I heard, or that's what I took away or something. So I feel like if I can feel these things we've talked about, of feeling safe and comfortable, that I can let go and be, there's a more, I don't know what that is. And I sometimes am curious, is this my ego who's just like, of course the sun can't rise without me? Are you kidding? Like, I want to make sure it's not my ego self doing like, I'm still here, you know. But I really do believe that, you know, the heart, the love doesn't die. So it's lives on in those who are loving you. And I feel like being in that state is yeah, it's like just love, just being love. I've had a couple, I've had two journeys with psychedelic medicines, one with psilocybin and one with MDMA. This was both guided journeys with a professional person. And in both of those, the psilocybin in particular, I was sort of underground and would come above ground, but I was able to navigate both worlds. And I was also, in other images I've had of like, where does spirit live? That's really the question that I ask. It's like, well, where am I? Like, how am I? How do I connect? Like, and I don't know those questions. I don't know those answers at all, but I just know now, like when I see the sun setting or rising, which happens every day, the colors, or even throughout the day, the colors of the clouds and the sky changes. And it's so beautiful. And there's this little amazing pockets of beautiful light. And like, I want to jump through into there because to me, that's spirit. That's what it looks like. Or like, if I see the moon and it's so, you know, like vibrant, I think it's like a hole. And like, I could jump in there. Maybe that's where spirit lives. Like, I don't know. But I just know these images help me feel into spirit being really everywhere. It's like it's in air, it's in trees, it's in earth, it's in your heart, it's in yourself. And that's sort of what I think about God too. It's like everywhere.